enjoy your year, do what you gotta do, be productive, get your rest in, drink your water, and remember that you are loved. Your existence makes a difference. Keep it plural, everyone. Peace, love, unity, and respect on and off the dance floor. Until next time, everyone, thank you so much. I'm DJ Amayita, and I had so much fun with you all. Enjoy the rest of your lovely, beautiful, amazing weekend. Happy Friday and happy 2025.
Welcome to Talk World Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
This week on Talk World Radio, a new analysis finds that over the past decade, the U.S. government has given to foreign nations' militaries 40 times the money it has paid into the Green Climate Fund. We have two guests from the Institute for Policy Studies. Aspen Coriz Romero is the 2024-25 IPS New Mexico Fellow, and Hannah Homestead is a research analyst with the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Aspen and Hannah, welcome to Talk World Radio.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, thank you, David.
Aspen, for people who don't know, what is the Green Climate Fund and what has the U.S. government done to fund it?
Okay, yeah. So the Green Climate Fund was a multilateral fund that was established in 2014. It relies on pledges and support from parties under the UNFCCC, which is the United Nations Conference for Climate Change. And it's the largest global fund that's dedicated to tackling climate change. It operates as a vehicle directing funding from countries to climate initiatives, and specifically initiatives in the most climate vulnerable countries. It kind of acts as like a bucket pooling funding from public funding, which would come from countries, as well as private funding to support those initiatives. And as of 2024, the U.S. has contributed a total of $2 billion to the Green Climate Fund. We are the fifth largest contributor to this fund, which is interesting considering the size of the U.S. economy compared to our contribution. So there are other countries who are much larger contributors to this fund.
And it's also important to note that the funding for the Green Climate Fund is very controversial, really divided among party lines, where we've seen Presidents Obama and President Biden request funding in their annual presidential budgets to direct funding to the Green Climate Fund. But Congress has actually never approved funding for the Green Climate Fund. It's always zeroed out that budget line. President Trump didn't even request any funding for that in the budget. But we were able to Presidents Obama and Biden were able to transfer previously allocated funding from the State Department to this fund. So it's something that's been really hard to achieve, where we have our presidents and we have administrations coming in making pledges to these funds, but then delivering on those pledges is really difficult given the climate in Congress.
So if it were really up to Congress, it wouldn't even be the $2 billion. It would be about nothing.
It would be $0. And at the same time, as we know, over the same period, they've approved almost $80 billion. Congress has, stamped approval for $80 billion worth of financing that goes to other countries to be able to purchase U.S. weapons. So this is just the money that we give other countries to buy weapons from the U.S. Defense industrial base. Why? So we think about, what are we subsidizing here? What are we financing? Climate catastrophe versus militarization and endless war.
You use that bizarre word defense, but we're talking about the U.S. government giving money to other countries' militaries. Why is it doing that at all to begin with?
That's a great question. Well, in terms of foreign military financing, which is just one type of military aid, just want to be clear on that. The United States provides training, provides grants, and provides lots of different types of military aid. Foreign military financing is one type. Again, and this is specifically money, specifically only to buy U.S. weapons from U.S. weapons manufacturers. And there's a number of strategic and ideological and material interests that are driving this. There's this belief that militarization and closer integration of our military with partners around the world will keep us safer, that there's a peace through strength, but we've seen, you know, increasing conflicts and increasing wars and increasing disasters, including also climate crisis, which is a byproduct also of all of this military spending. So we're seeing that that's not truly the case. That's a big reason, part of the belief that the militarization keeps us safe, when actually it's driving more conflict and it's actually driving the climate crisis. Our militaries are the biggest contributors to the climate crisis, and that is our greatest global threat. So funding continual militarization is not only advancing safety, it's actually counterproductive to peace and security and safety.
Indeed. There's another belief, if that's the right word for it, that democracy is being advanced. But many of these governments getting these free piles of money to buy weapons are brutal dictatorships, according to the U.S. government's own State Department, correct?
That is correct. We are selling weapons to many countries that are violating not only U.S. law around human rights abuses. There are laws, as we've known and we've seen over the last year with the genocide in Gaza, there are U.S. laws on the books that say the United States government is not allowed to transfer weapons to countries that are committing gross violations of human rights. So we see those laws continually, you know, not being implemented. There's also, though, international laws around this as well, which is continually violated. And again, this is this belief that there's a bigger strategic goal of growing these military partnerships. And a lot of that is around resource control and, you know, strategic resources, which we all know what those are in the Middle East.
And certain people getting stinking rich, I imagine, as well. I am not very good at math, but this 40 times, if you look at the U.S. government spending on its own military as very roughly $1 trillion, that looks to me like 5,000 times what it's put into the Green Climate Fund. And even if you looked at U.S. environmental spending domestically, it's absolutely dwarfed by the military spending, right?
That is absolutely true. And Aspen, feel free to jump in here too. I don't mean to, but yes, no. And when we look at even comparing the Defense Department annual bill, we're on track right now. Congress is about to approve $895 billion bill. But when we look at total militarization, it's over $1 trillion. And then we look at the Inflation Reduction Act, which was passed in 2022, that's supposed to be our major investment in clean energy, and that was $360 billion or so. So we see, you know, we're passing double, and that was over a decade of spending. So we're passing twice the amount of our biggest investment in clean energy and infrastructure for our domestic investment. We're passing twice the size of that bill every year when that bill was for 10 years. So there's a huge disparity again in terms of what we are investing in and for our future. And this really does also come out through our supply chains and through our, you know, we're seeing what we're producing and how that's shaping the world. For example, the United States produces around 40%, 40 to 50% of the world's weapons. We produce 2% of the world's solar panels, whereas China is producing 80% of the world's solar panels and producing less than 5% of the world's weapons. And so we're seeing these decisions around what we're investing in domestically having repercussions, not only in the United States, of course, but how we're impacting the world.
It's incredible that this bill you mentioned, the infrastructure bill, and President Biden have gotten credit as greatest environmental spending and heroes ever, which seems to depend on just ignoring the existence of the military spending or treating it as unquestionable, because otherwise it doesn't look very good, does it?
doesn't.
It doesn't. And also when we look at too the kind of unbridled oil and gas drilling that's been happening as well, you know, the investment in the Inflation Reduction Act had a lot of great, you know, investments there, and you know, that's important and we need more. It's really was just a first step though, like kind of a down payment in terms of what's actually needed to make a real just energy transition work. So while we've had that one step forward, we've also seen record levels of oil and gas drilling continue under the Biden administration, which is continuing to exacerbate the climate crisis. And we know that the United States is the greatest contributor of carbon in the atmosphere today that's causing the climate crisis. We're the greatest cumulative producer of carbon emissions, which again is why we have an obligation to be contributing towards funds like the Green Climate Fund, which are trying to mitigate those harmful impacts on that are happening in the places that are least responsible for creating the climate change that's impacting them today. And so we have this real strategic obligation, but also moral obligation, legal obligation to be contributing more and to be funding these solutions instead of continuing to fund militarization, which is a root problem.
Yeah. Aspen, there was recently another one of these UN COP meetings that was supposed to address just this need to spend more money on preventing climate disaster rather than creating military disasters. How did that go?
Not very well. It was kind of a bad deal. The first number, which is referred to as an NCQG, which stands for a nationally or cumulative quantified. Hold on. I'm sorry. I forgot what it stands for.
It's the quantum goal.
I think it's the cumulative goal. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like there's too many acronyms. Okay. So the cumulative goal that was first established was $100 billion a year by the year 2020. That goal was not reached. The new goal that was established at COP29 this year in Baku is $300 billion, which isn't much more and is significantly less than the need right now. Estimates for the need to transition countries in the global south are in the trillions at the moment. So it was not a great deal. A lot of the asks from the global south were being ignored, and it was just not a very productive COP. We had the president there referring to the president of Azerbaijan at the COP referring to oil and gas as gifts from God. It was not a very productive diplomatic gathering.
Is the problem, as that would seem to suggest, simply insanity, or is it corruption by the profiteers, or is it the roadblock to cooperation that's created by all the militarism, another side benefit of putting all the money into wars? Why is it that these conferences do the opposite of what they're supposed to do?
I think it's a bit of both of those things. Azerbaijan is deeply tied into oil, as well as militarism and histories of military violence, and is very connected to the genocide now in Israel. So I think that when we think about oil and gas and fossil fuels, we also have to think about how those are so deeply interlinked with militarism. The U.S. spends, this is an older estimate, but about $81 billion annually, quote unquote, defending global oil supplies. So these things are deeply connected and feed into each other. And when we think about one, we definitely need to be thinking about the other.
That's great.
Do you want to add to that, Hannah?
I was just going to say, no, that's completely true, like the root of this crisis. And also, it's just so disheartening when you see these opportunities for collaboration, and then there's reports coming out that there's actually like more oil and gas drilling deals coming out of these climate conferences than actually real like climate policy. And we have to think too, you know, about, you mentioned the corruption aspect, where we have members of Congress in our, you know, in the United States, I'll say, that are actually invested materially within the stock market, in stocks of defense contractors, of oil companies, of
of these industries that are at the root of a lot of these of a lot of our global, you know, global issues. And so when you have regulators that are invested in the stocks of the companies they're supposed to be regulating, there's a lot there. How do we even, you know, start talking about accountability on that? But that's a really important piece of all of this work.
We, I believe, just saw recently in the House of so-called Representatives another $895 billion tossed into the war machine with hardly a debate aside from a side issue of transgender health care over the amount of money. And I think one congresswoman saying anything encouraging no votes prior, and that was just hours prior, not a single protest of it, to my knowledge, by the U.S. public anywhere. And if a fraction of that were proposed to pass through Congress for anything useful, the environment or anything else, I believe there would be an enormous stink about how much it costs and where are you going to find the money? How is this possible?
Yeah, there's always money for war, but not for our other social needs, as we know. And we know how that this money could be redirected towards actual investment in our communities that would have much more return, higher return on investment. If we're talking about peace and security and stability, we also know the Pentagon just failed another audit, right? And that there's the Pentagon is rife with waste, fraud, and abuse. And so legislators that are and members, you know, of the new administration who are interested in cutting wasteful government spending can probably spend a little time at the Pentagon on that, and it would be really beneficial for us all.
This is another question I have, Aspen or Hannah. This so-called Department of Government Efficiency that wants to make the government efficient without touching tax breaks for billionaires, fossil fuel subsidies, military spending, any of the massively wasteful things. What is it going to do? And you see Elon Musk, billionaire put in charge of avoiding taxing billionaires, trading tweets back and forth with Congressman Ro Khanna, and they don't like the F-35 and so forth. But do they have any power to derail the F-35? And if they do it because Elon wants to make money off drones and rockets, is it really a good step? What do you see coming down the road here?
It is, I mean, it is interesting, you know, and first we just want to note too, there's already an agency called the Government Accountability Office that looks towards and puts out reports on how to save taxpayer money and how the government can be streamlined and how to cut waste, fraud, and abuse in the government. This already exists. It's the Government Accountability Office. They're a wonderful, you know, nonpartisan agency that they do incredible work. And so a lot of this redundancy is not necessarily, we know, to actually, you know, make the government work better to provide better services to our communities, which we'd like to see. Again, these are opportunities to continue to maintain the system that's serving a status quo, primarily corporations in this country, at the you know, detriment to all of our global well-being. Actually, in terms of the F-35 and the drones, I mean, the F-35s are things that are budgeted out for very long periods of time, actually for decades. So I don't know, I can't speak to exactly like if what, you know, Elon Musk's ability to change, you know, the actual spending on that. But, you know, I maybe this will be a time where more folks will be drawn into this conversation around wasteful government spending. And I think that ultimately will be good, because once people see the discrepancy about what kind of future we're really investing in for ourselves and our communities and our children, when we're spending all of this on militarization, and really who is it serving? You know, who's better off today? Every standard quality, every standard of living measurement, which we can measure, is declining in the United States and around the world. Inequality is expanding, authoritarianism expanding. So what are we solving, you know, with this current system? I think as we've seen with the reaction to the murder of the UnitedHealthcare CEO, people are really fed up and angry. And I think that we're going to have to really start really grappling with that as a nation very soon.
Fed up and angry and accepting of murder, a couple of problems in my view. You two are bringing together, you know, supposedly two different issues, environment and militarism. I just had a couple of guests on this program, one from Veterans for Peace, one from 350.org, who are working together opposing military air shows because of all the pollution, among other reasons. And I asked them, and they seem to think that environmental groups are more open to working with peace groups now, and not because of all the strong arguments you're making and all the crazy numbers we can't even comprehend, but because of Gaza. Do you have any similar experience? What are your thoughts on the ability to bring these two fields of activism together?
I think I could speak to that one a little bit. I think that Gaza has revived and revamped a lot of the anti-war movement and brought in a lot of people to see that militarism is not the thing that is going to keep us safer. It's actually doing counterproductive things and is actually extremely harmful. And in terms of connecting it to an environment, I can say that when I first joined the climate movement, I was probably about 17. Militarism was not an aspect of the thing that we were talking about, even though it definitely should be. But I think in a lot of movements, people can tend to be in silos. But it's great to see that Gaza is bringing together a lot of different issues, not just environment and anti-war. A lot of people are coming around this issue because there are so many interconnected parts to militarism. In terms of Gaza, when we think about ecocide, there is a lot of environmental degradation being done by the IDF, both in Gaza and the West Bank and just broader Palestine. So I think that's just a part where we're building some momentum, and I hope to see that momentum continue to go forward.
And I would just say, too, that the environmental destruction and that aspect, I completely agree. And it's so great that you're like even seeing this transformation in your work since joining the work. But it's also I think something we need to understand, too, in the United States is that we are also severely impacted by the environmental impacts of war, both because of the contribution to global emissions, which is driving climate crisis. And as we know, there's these worsening storms, there's droughts and fires. We know how this is affecting us and, of course, the most vulnerable and least responsible communities around the world. But also there's when we make these things here in the United States, there's a huge environmental cost. You know, our water is full of PFAS right now. PFAS are from the military. PFAS were created during the process of creating the atomic bomb, and then were commercialized to make dual use, which is how these things happen. And our water and PFAS contamination is extremely worrisome, and affects things like even vaccine efficacy in children. And so we're kind of playing this gamble where we're allowing unfettered militarism to happen. The production of a lot of these munitions also creates lots of toxicity around bases that are then leached into the water table and spread through our water, that are exacerbated by floods like Hurricane Helene, which flooded the Radford Army ammunition plant and spread toxins over the whole area. And so these are things that also affect us. We should be caring about these genocides, but it also is directly impacting our water quality in the United States too. Of course, there's also police militarization. There's also the exorbitant spending on militarism at the expense of other priorities like climate finance and like, you know, renewable energy. So there's so many ways that these movements are so interconnected, and it is really encouraging to see more cross movement work.
It is indeed. I hope people will visit militarypoisons.org, set up by a previous guest on this program, Pat Elder. Another recent guest has a book out called The Green New Deal from Below, about how states and cities and counties are advancing Green New Deal programs, given the failure, the general failure of the federal government. But that doesn't go after the military, because the military is national. What do we just give up? Do we just wait for a different emperor in five more years? What can we do to advance the cause that these numbers you're throwing at us clearly cry out for?
The answer is not give up. Aspen just wrote a great blog. Aspen, do you want to take the first?
Yeah, I could go ahead. So I wrote a blog recently on our website, which is nationalpriorities.com or .org, nationalpriorities.org. And a lot of the movement that we're going to need is going to have to come from below, reflecting again on our earlier comments about COP, reflecting on the presidency of Joe Biden passing the IRA, but also having record high gas and oil exports. The change that we need is not going to be coming from the top. The change that we need is going to be coming from the bottom, from the grassroots movements. And you were talking about local and state initiatives. There's been a lot of great stuff this election season. For example, California just passed a climate bond of $10 billion for climate resiliency and wildfire management. So people getting in contact with their local representatives and getting things passed at the local level is really key right now, especially as we are about to enter a second Trump presidency. Trump is very, very famous for being a climate denialist, so we cannot expect him to make the changes we need. We are going to have to start from below. And just to build off what Hannah said, not giving up, not giving into despair, because change is possible and change is necessary.
We've got about 2 minutes left. What can people do to get involved, and what can people do to follow your work?
That's a great question. And also, too, I want to just reiterate, too, that this is a point that, or working on for the climate and against militarism is something that's broadly popular throughout the United States. And we know that polling shows that 70% of Americans disapprove of selling weapons to foreign countries, while 75% of Americans say that they support U.S. participation in international efforts to reduce the effects of the climate crisis. So we know where we all stand. And it really is about building the movements and getting together to organize to make sure our elected officials are being held accountable. This is something, right, that we're all on board with. We all want a livable future. And there are a lot of number of ways to get involved.
And are we, almost all of us, oppose selling weapons to foreign countries? How many of us oppose giving weapons to foreign countries?
That's a good question.
That's what we started out talking about. I assume just about everybody, right?
Yeah. Well, the foreign military financing is money we give, right, in order for to allow them to buy our weapons. So it's a massive subsidy to the weapons manufacturers, essentially. But right, giving or selling, I believe the numbers are still pretty much the same in terms of the polling on that, where it's most people are not super stoked that the United States is the world's largest arms dealer.
I don't know if you can poll on it, because I don't know if anybody knows it's happening, and they won't poll something if people don't even know it's going on. But I interrupted you. We got like a minute left. Well, how can people keep up with what you guys are doing?
Yeah, well, we definitely, please do visit our website. Again, it's www.nationalpriorities.org. We put out blog posts and analysis on the federal budget and kind of recent events that are going on. We put out some good information around, the different investments that we have in FEMA and disaster response and mitigation versus militarization, in response to Hurricane Helene and other disasters like that. So we have a lot of information there. We're on social media. We hope that everyone keeps in touch with us. And also, if you're a researcher, we do try and help movements and researchers with data about the federal budget. So please do reach out. Our contact information is online. And thank you so much for talking with us and for having us.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Aspen Coriz Romero and with Hannah Homestead, both from the Institute for Policy Studies and from the National Priorities Project, which is part of the Institute for Policy Studies. We will have links up at talkworldradio.org. Aspen and Hannah, thank you for coming on Talk World Radio.
Thank you so much.
This is Talk World Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. Read or listen to today's Peace Almanac entry at peacealmanac.org. All past shows can be heard at talkworldradio.org. Talk World Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way.